wasn't talking about whether it's convenient for you.
I'm talking about overbreath in this log.
Hello, Dead Dog Records.
Pick up some tapes. Listen to the current recording.
Current recording.
The one you're making as we speak.
Hold on a minute. Got you guys are listening to everything.
Bugs are there for your protection.
I know.
You either have no ability to use this for any purpose whatsoever, either for free or for money. You want to test me in the courts? If we did not buy ownership, we bought exclusivity. And if you want to try and check me out, and you go ahead and try and do something with it, and I'm going to sue your ass. You can never use it without our permission. So I sent you the check. I own it or I control it. You can never use it for anything without my permission. And if you want to challenge me, we'll go to court tomorrow and I'll prove you wrong. And you want to find out? Let's go.
Maybe he won't.
I'm telling you the facts of law and the facts of reality here. The reality is I gave you money, I own it or I control it. If you want to try and do something with it, I'm going to sue you. You never use it for any purpose again or I will sue you.
Maybe he's right. Maybe there is something the matter with me. I just don't see how a world that makes such wonderful things could be bad.
You want to test me in the court?
Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat?
I control.
Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Wouldn't you think I'm the girl?
Let's go.
Girl who has everything.
You can never use it without our permission.
Look at this tool. Treasures untold.
I control.
How many wonders can one cavern hold? Looking around here, you see.
I own it.
Sure. She's got everything.
You can't use it.
I've got gadgets and gizmos of plenty. I've got who's it and what's it for.
I'm gonna see your ass.
You want thingamabob? I got 20. But who cares? No big deal. I want more.
So I got to be at this thing in Duke University in November called the Conference on the Public Domain. And I showed this to a room full of 150 intellectual property lawyers. It's great. It was like one of the greatest moments of my life. It was just so funny because they all were laughing. And I was sitting next to Kerry Sherman. Do you know who this is? This is the guy who sued Napster. He's the chief legal counsel for the RIAA. He's laughing at this. And, you know, I said, Kerry, you know, should you go out in the hall and call your friends at Disney and, you know, have them come gunning for us? Or what? What do you think? You know, look at what we did. And he said, no, I can see that that's fair use. So that's very interesting to me. That's very interesting to me. And another thing, I wanted to tell you another story, is that a couple years after we did the book, in 98, our pressing plant, our CD pressing plant we had been working with for many, many years, suddenly announced it would no longer press any of our CDs because it had noticed certain things on them that we had not said we owned. You know, samples we hadn't cleared. And it turned out these new guidelines had been issued by the RIAA telling pressing plants to be on the lookout not only for pirated and bootleg CDs and software CDs, but listen for samples. Because if they're not cleared, that's an infringement. Well, that's bullshit. That's not true. And so we talked to a bunch of lawyers, because by now we were friends with lawyers who liked us and would give us free advice. And we put out a very lengthy press release basically saying this was like a form of prior restraint. If I can't, it may be an infringement, it may not, but it's really up to the person who's infringed upon to make that claim, and I can't have my day in court to defend myself if I'm not allowed to publish, right? So we put out this press release and urged, this is where a hacker-type person was able to help us. He was able to get the email address of every single person who worked at the RIAA, and we attached that to this email announcement and urged anyone who supported what we were doing to please write a nice letter to the RIAA and CC everybody who worked there, just so they all know. And so they got a lot of letters to the point where finally, and you've got to remember, this is before she was the superstar villain. My phone rings and it's Hillary Rosen calling me on the telephone. She's the head of the RIAA, and she's saying, "Look, we're getting all these letters from your fans." And the interesting thing is that the RIAA really likes to think of itself as being a friend of the artist. They really do. They do. It's insane, and it's obvious they're not. But they think this way. It's the same thing as the reason we were able to get so under the skin of the band U2 was not because we had any real power. It's because U2 is a bunch of guys who like to get up in the morning and look at themselves in the mirror and they think, I'm a good guy. I do good stuff. And when you do something in whatever you do, politically, activism, creativity, those people are very vulnerable because it has everything to do with their self-image. And so the RIAA doesn't want to seem to be anti-artist. So unbelievably, they came to me and they said, well, what would Negative Land like the guidelines to actually say to the pressing plants? Because we're not trying to stop people like you from doing your work. So this is a very surreal experience. I have it all recorded on tape, of course. And And I said, you need to amend your guidelines so it says that there is a legal gray area, that all samples are not automatically an infringement. And they went ahead and they actually took the language we asked them to put in, and they put it in. They did this. Now, the practical effect of this is not necessarily so great, because a CD pressing plant is a business. They're going to always want to err on the side of being more conservative. But it did mean that we were actually able to find another pressing plant who knew about us, they knew what we did, they sort of knew what we were up to, but they looked at this sort of new delineation of the gray area, and they actually let us press our CDs there. I know people nowadays, there's still plants where people who are doing collage-type work have problems, but we're doing okay. And that story, and the story I told you about Carrie Sherman, the legal counsel from the RIAA, tells me an interesting thing. It tells me that I think that the kind of work that we were doing, I think, is off their legal radar now. Because with Napster, file sharing, they're worrying about Morpheus and Audio Galaxy. And they're worrying about their entire business model collapsing underneath them. And all the attorneys who work for them are much, much busier doing other things than worrying about little people like us. So I kind of feel like, I could be wrong, but I kind of feel like an era has kind of come to a close in that regard, where I really don't think anyone who's doing this kind of appropriation is going to have a problem. Unless you're making a lot of money doing it, but I don't know how you would ever do that. Because the problem is still getting stuff made. These shorts I'm showing you, there's a lot more of them, and we would like to put them out as a DVD. We're working on compiling them. I don't know what trouble we're going to run into when we try and actually replicate the DVD. I mean, the plant might freak out. We may end up having to find some place that does pirates Madonna CDs in the Ukraine to do this. I hope not. But it kind of just seems to me like at least a tiny little crack opened up in their head where they actually could see that, okay, maybe there's these areas where fair use is not just about quoting and criticism or science, but there's actually this whole other area which is just about making weird-ass art shit. And that, and maybe that's okay, and we don't need to worry about it. So, anyway, I'm gonna talk some more, but let me take some more questions. Can you turn the lights up just a little bit while I do this in the room so I can see people? Okay. Or just say it and I'll repeat it. Yeah. Our stuff is actually, it's funny, we've actually never, his question is there's stuff available for download, and there's so much of it out there on all the file sharing programs that we kind of just thought it didn't matter. So, that's true. But we do absolutely everything ourselves, and trying to run a record label, put out new records, do this kind of thing I'm doing here, and run a website means that I was actually one place where we really, believe it or not, we haven't had the stuff up there. Of course, if people are, one of the things that I think is a really ridiculous part of the whole argument against downloading is the whole notion that every download is a lost sale. You know, there's 30,000 records released last year. I think we're in the of major labels. That doesn't include all the indie labels. I mean, the real number could be twice that or more. And if you're a big fan of music like I am, you know, you just want to hear, there's just a million things you'd love to hear. And so the notion that every time you're checking out a piece of music that's somehow stealing from them is just so stupid. It's ridiculous.
I read somewhere that different corporations have actually asked Negative Land to produce television commercials for them. Is that true?
Sure, that's a good story. Negative Land, when did this happen? 98, 99? We got a phone call from Wieden & Kennedy. Wieden & Kennedy is the ad agency that does Nike and Microsoft. There's a couple of hotshot guys there. These are the people who had William Burroughs doing a Nike ad. You know, homosexual, heroin addict, wife killer, selling you tennis shoes. This is the cutting edge in advertising, right? And relative to the world that these people occupy, it really is. These guys called us on the phone. They're big fans of our group. We loved you guys when you were in college, and they wanted to hire Negative Land, not because we're, you know, celebrities or anything. They wanted just to hire us to do the creation and production on a series of ads for Miller Genuine Draft Beer. So, I don't know if you can quite imagine how this felt. It was very depressing. I thought about it for about 15 seconds. I thought, God, they're offering us about $30,000, and I am really poor all the time. You know, and I would sure like that money. God, is there some way we could justify doing this? Is there some way we could subvert them in some way? And I realized, no, we're fucked, because that's what they're hiring us to do. They're hiring us to subvert the ad and to make some kind of mocking, cut-up, satirical thing. There was no way to outthink them. So I ended up telling them on the phone, and I said, this is incredibly depressing that you called on the phone and asked us to do this, and because I said, do you understand what our work is about? You know, it's funny, it's comical, but in the end, it's really all about wanting to see the world that you're a part of and what you promote destroyed. And I said, we couldn't look I could not look at myself in the mirror in the morning if I took your money and did your job. And, you know, he would blow our street credibility, man. So we ended up turning it down. We ended up turning that down. But I it was an amazing... Thank you. So you shouldn't be clapping. That shouldn't be a big deal that someone does that, really. It should be that trying to maintain some level of an ethical, moral, and some kind of integrity is just... And that shouldn't be any kind of a big deal. But it was an amazing... Again, it was something I kind of already knew, but it was an amazing experience to see to what degree, you know, the revolution will be commodified. That anything that you're going to do that's in any kind of oppositional form is going to be used. I know after the WTO protests in Seattle, the Gap in one city, I don't remember if it was here or in what city, actually had a window display that had spray-painted circle A's over the clothes in the window display. It was where, Cambridge?
Yeah.
Okay. Which is not to say you shouldn't be trying to go after these guys, but it's just a very sobering thing that they know you're out there trying to get them and you're going to do something. And, you know, they have people... Well, Naomi Klein's written about it in her book No Logo, which is an amazing book. And there's people called cool hunters whose job is to go to big cities. You know, they'll get some kind of 20-something tattooed, pierced-looking person, dyed black hair, and hang out in some scene or another and report back to them on what's going on, what's kind of the new cutting edge of style, language, music, dress, etc. And that is being looked at. So there's no chance for subcultures to develop like they may have done 20 or 30, 40 years ago, where they could kind of develop and kind of get their own legs in some way before they got co-opted. Because they always do. It's always going to happen. But the speed in which it happens now, the speed in which it is kind of recapitulated back into the system is just like so fast. So... again, that's not something to stop one from doing anyone's political or creative or activist type work, but it's a very sobering thing. It's good to think about. So, anyway, other questions? Yeah. Would it have made a difference if it was some other product that we liked? I don't really think so. I just think the whole act of doing it. Or someone might say, would you do it if they gave you $300,000 or $3 million? You know, it's like, well, they didn't. So I can't, I don't know. We don't have, I mean, believe, I don't know what I'm coming, how I'm coming across, but Negative Land does not have some absolute rules about anything we do. It's just like on a case-by-case basis, you sort of say, what are we going to do here? So yeah. Yes. The what? Oh, you're just wondering about when we tried to directly contact Casey Kasem? Well, that's kind of I'm trying to think of a simple way to answer that. It's not too long. Yeah, the book's very good, but no. Well, I don't know how many of you know this book called Hitman by Frederick Dannen, which details all the payola and corruption in the music industry that still goes on to this day. We sent him a letter with that. No, he sent us a letter urging us to sort of stop bugging him and sent us a copy of The Power of Positive Thinking. So, yeah, we sent him a copy of this book, Hitman, to sort of say, well, I mean, in fact, Casey Kasem, and this is why we were able to get under his skin, Casey Kasem is an animal rights activist. He has been arrested for civil disobedience for protesting nuclear testing. He is one of the only people in Hollywood who spoke out against the invasion of Iraq. So relative to the system he is a part of, he's a really interesting and remarkable guy. And again, another guy who really wants to think he's a good guy when he looks at himself in the morning. So some of the stuff that spun out of the lawsuits against us really did get under his skin in that kind of way. So,
going back to the Christianity is stupid thing, I read somewhere that you actually were at a party and somebody lived in the town. Is that correct?
That's true. This is just one of these strange things where you're doing this art that's very removed from this stuff, and then suddenly you're hit in the face by the reality of it. And no, just very recently, I was actually at a party where I met some people who grew up with the boy who killed his mother, brother, sister, and Father with an axe. And they told me this story. Well, one, they hated our group for doing what we did. They hated me, even though they didn't know me. But the thing they told me that was so mind-blowing was, it turned out that David Brom, the axe murderer's brother, Joe, ran a little tiny punk rock record store in the basement of their parents' house, and that they had Negative Land records in that store in the house. And that when the town was people were looking for some kind of explanation of why did this happen, really, because no one wanted to look at, well, this happened because this kid has been brutalized by these parents who were making him go. I later found out that he was forced to go to a mass at church something like 4 times a week. Is the battery dying? Is it cutting out right here? He just lost the sound from the front right here. Anyway, and what I heard was that our fabricated news story connecting our music to the axe murder made its way back to the town, and actually people started thinking that was the reason why the axe murders happened. So this incredibly bizarre feedback loop happened went even way further than we ever knew. So I only found that out recently. It was pretty strange. So... No, we got to a magazine called Mondo 2000 was approached by U2 because U2 wanted to be in the magazine because they were going for this new kind of cyberpunk kind of image, right? So they thought that fit. So one of the editors of U2, who was slightly friends with us, and he called us on the phone and he said, "Mark, would you like to do the interview with The Edge? And you can do whatever you want." And we did. We had had a very interesting time on the phone with him. But that would take too long to explain. But, it's the book we published, the whole thing is completely transcribed. I'm hoping for, if you've got questions that are about bigger stuff than just some of our soap opera stuff, because I think given what this whole event is about, that would be good to try and speak to. So those kind of questions. So, yeah. Radio, well, this amazing thing is happening with Clear Channel has bought up every single radio station in the country, and they're turning all the radio everywhere is sounding the same. And this kind of interesting thing is happening where it's seemingly starting to backfire. Their market share is going down because people really want to hear more diversity. And I read an interesting study, and I never know what to think. I never trust studies, but a study that was questioning people who did, who were on Napster and various music file sharing programs, and they asked people, like, before you were using these programs, what would you say your musical? What were you a fan of musically, and what do you like now? And what they found was that a huge number, like 60% of the people, after being on something like Napster and being able to explore and try out new stuff and get beyond what was on just top 40 radio, now said, "I don't just like heavy metal. I like, you know, this country western or electronica, or I like this ambient techno, whatever." And that this amazing thing was happening where, in fact, people are craving more diversity and more stuff. So this interesting thing's happening, and I've been thinking this about corporations in general. Looking at what happened with WorldCom and with Enron, is this? It used to be that the way you ran your business was you were looking at an economic model that looked ahead to say 5, 10, 20, 50 years. This thing has evolved now where it's all about showing that you can make a profit by quarterly, because it's all tied to your stock option plan. So if you fire 30,000 employees and your stock goes up, that's good. It's not actually good. That's stupid. But it looks good. And the CEO who made the decision, because his pay is tied to the stock options, you know, he gets more pay. Anyway, so there's this imperative built in. It's evolved particularly over the last 10 years, which is grow or die. If you're running a company, you must grow or die. There's no such model in the corporate world of sustainability. Well, I think that's starting to bite them in the ass in a really interesting way, because you can't grow forever. It can't be done. You could consolidate the record labels down from 8 to 7 to 6 to the now 5, but are you going to get away with 4 or 3 or 2? Are people going to let that happen? Even people who want to let you do it, who you're paying off in Congress? You can't. There's a certain point where you can't keep growing. And looking what's happened with Vivendi and with WorldCom, and it would appear that they've gotten to be so big that they can't coordinate themselves in any way that works anymore. There's been studies that are showing that financial institutions get to be a certain size and they start to make less and less money. So I'm kind of wondering what's going to be happening over the next 5-10 years as this, you know, this incredible, frightening push to the consolidation of everything, the corporatization of everything on the fucking planet. But maybe there's some kind of weird self-correcting thing that starts to kick in. That occasionally makes me optimistic. I know. I don't know. It's interesting. I'm personally, what worries me there's a bazillion microwave transmitters that have gone up all over this country that are blasting my body everywhere I go, and I'm kind of a little bit worried about, you know. In fact, this is maybe show how ignorant I am, but I only just realized that for Sprint and VoiceStream and Nextel, that every single one of those wireless systems has their own set of towers. So there's not just one set out there everywhere. There's like many, 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 many of them. And the more we go to wireless, you know, there isn't enough being. It should be looked at as a health issue and examined before we're all. But we're being plunged into a world where we're being blasted with it. So wireless is a lot of fun, but it's. I think it's a lot. We ought to be a lot more scared of it. So let's see. Whoops. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
How do you feel about other people using their lives and stuff in their
work? Well, what would you think? It's really none of my business. I mean, we keep a list on our website of negative samples of all the people we find out about who've sampled from us. And I think it's a lot of fun. I heard this great dance track in this kind of Indian disco style called Bhangra. And sampled from Negative Land, and the idea that our music made us all the way over to India, and someone was inspired to take something from us and use it, I thought was fantastic. The best story, though, of that is when I have been asked, you know, well, what would you do if someone stole something from Negative Land and they sold 1 million records? Well, that's happened. Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, now known as Mark Wahlberg, star of Planet of the Apes, et cetera, et cetera. He did a record called Music for the People. The first 5 seconds of that record, when you put on the CD, is from Negative Land, stolen straight off it. We actually stole from the part of him where he disses our sample. We used that at the end of the Little Mermaid track that I showed you, because we thought if he didn't mind stealing from us, I mean, if he stole from us, he probably wouldn't mind if we stole from them. Interesting, that record sold about 1 million copies. And that was interesting, too, because he did clear a lot of the samples. But for some reason, no one ever, you know, we weren't asked. Who else did that? Fatboy Slim sampled from us and went to our now ex, the ex record label we were on, the one that sued us, SST. And for some stupid reason, he went to them asking permission. And they asked for $1,000. And I got wind of this before the record came out. And I contacted Fatboy Slim's record label saying, no, 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 don't pay the money, you can have it, we don't care, you know, it's absolutely fine. And I couldn't get through to him. The managers and lawyers I talked to, of course, thought I was insane. And so he ended up paying the $1,000 to our ex-record label, who kept all the money. Legally, I think they were supposed to split it with us, but we never saw any of it. And then the wonderful irony of it was that he then licensed that track to Coca-Cola to be used in a Pepsi commercial. I'm sorry, to... I can't even... Sorry, I have my colas mixed up. He licensed it to Coca-Cola to be used in a Coke commercial. And the bit that he paid $1,000 to sample was something that we had stolen from somebody and we'd never gotten permission for. So we publicized this just because we thought it was so silly and ridiculous. This guy's just paid a grand for a sample we had no right to sell him to a record label that we aren't on anymore, who won't give us the money anyway, and you're using it in a Coke commercial on network television. So, which actually leads me into this last short video I'm going to show you. We had been interested in advertising. Obviously, this is a subject that is very, very near and dear to Negative Land's heart. And we decided to do a project that, instead of focusing on advertising in general, we decided to relentlessly focus on one single product, mainly because we had a lot of material in our archives that related to this product, but also because we thought it would kind of make for a cooler, weirder art project. And kind of, it's not that we have anything particularly against this one product, which is Pepsi, but it just seemed like by the end of the record, we hoped to make this record that people would really like, but at the end of it, they'd just be sick of hearing about Pepsi. So this is an actual song, like a song, singing and lyrics that we wrote, and this is something where we've tried to imagine what would Negative Land do if we were hired by Pepsi to make an ad? What would our version of a jingle be? So we're going to show that. And it's called The Greatest Taste Around.
Of every person at Pepsi Cola are with you.
I got fired by my boss.
Pepsi. We have to look great. Pepsi Cola.
I nailed Jesus to the cross. Pepsi.
Well, you gotta pay the price.
Powdered mashed potatoes in the cupboard for 3 years.
I'm going to take just a few more questions because I think we're getting sort of toward the end here. So, yeah.
So, have you spoken to a lot of groupings with its lawyers and people involved with technology that are like this one where it's predominantly male? And do you have any perspective yourself on technology and gender?
The question was about these, what is the question? About technology and gender. I certainly figured when I came out here that I was going to be a room full of mostly a bunch of guys. And that's true. And I wished there were more, I don't know to what degree efforts were made to get more women on panels that were here. It doesn't seem like there was that many. Were there? No, there was Robin Gross from EFF, and who else?
Linnea?
Not enough. And Okay, I didn't go to everything, so my apologies. But anyway, I mean, that's something I always wonder about whenever I've been to any presentations or film festivals or any event, is I always am curious whether people are trying to, you know, make an effort to have more gender balance, because unfortunately, it's too bad you have to try to do that, but I think, we still live in a world where we do need to try and do that. It's important to do. One of the things, though, that really was interesting and to me was when I went to this intellectual property conference I told you about, where all the intellectual property attorneys were, there was a lot of women who were there who are some of the leading thinkers in these fields, Pamela Samuelson. And I'm not sure what it is about intellectual property law, but there was a really good balance in there of men and women, and much, much different than what I expected. It's new. What? What? Say that again.
Okay. One of the things that people are noticing is that there are new fields opening up, or old fields that were small but are suddenly growing way beyond their bounds. You end up with a lot more women getting in because there isn't an old boys network keeping them out, and because it's interesting, it's new, and it's exciting, it's something to learn about,
right,
and it's challenging, which is part of the reason why I see a lot more women in technology than I do, for instance, when I talk to my friends in law enforcement.
Cool. That's great. Okay. Is there anyone like way back there that I'm? Yes, you who are standing.
You mentioned working in a nursery, and I'm wondering when negative land became a full-time job.
When did negative land become a full-time job? Well, first of all, I should say I never expected it to. I always assumed that you couldn't possibly make a living doing this stuff.
And how do you make a living?
This is what I do. I make a living. I am making a living right now. I sold so many CDs today, I couldn't believe it. It was great. And I can now fix my car. So thank you very much. No, I always just assumed, what I did was I had this job working as a nursery school teacher for about 5 or 6 years, and I would work about 30 hours a week, and it left me with enough. It was a job that I felt good about being in, and it left me with enough sort of brain power and space in my life that I could do this other stuff. Though I must say all the other teachers there always thought they didn't quite understand what I did in my free time. But that's why, like, you'll hear some recordings on some of our earlier records, like there's a little girl trying to sing Over the Rainbow with the hiccups. That was recorded on my job. And I like doing that because I think if our work has any positive effect at all, I mostly don't know about it. It's very, very abstract. And when you're doing something like working with kids, you know, if what you're doing is working, you know, right there, you know, and there's something that's very rewarding about that. So it's something that nowadays, I mean, I'm always struggling every month to try and make ends meet, but I have many friends who do much better than I financially. But, you know, they sort of say, like, well, they, you know, cut their right arm off if they were able to do something that really meant something to them and were able to scrape by. And it's just so painful to me to think about how many people in this country are doing work that is really meaningless to them. And that's what you do 40 or 50 hours a week. And imagine what that does to you, and if you're, you know, your relationship with your family or whatever. I think it's just, it's brutal. I mean, God, it's rough. So anyway, what happened was I burnt out on working at the nursery school job, and I decided to put more time into negative land and see if we could do a little bit better. And we did, and that was about 12 years ago. So I still keep expecting it any day to just sort of end, and I'm going to be serving yogurt in the mall. You know, I'm a high school graduate. That's it. So anyway, yeah. What's next for us? What's next for us is we're doing a project which doesn't fit into any of the things I've been talking about this evening whatsoever. At least I'd like to think so. Though we came up with the phrase culture jamming many, many years ago, and it's interesting that it's being used right now. Now, the part of me that never wants to belong to a club that would have me as a member, many of you may be like this, has sort of been very annoyed and frustrated at seeing how Adbusters has totally commodified it and turned it into culture jamming t-shirts and calendars and stuff. they mean well, and they obviously do reach a certain person in which I think they are having a positive effect. But it's sometimes just, you know, bugs the crap out of me. And so as much as we've gotten all this attention for a certain type of work in, you know, anti-corporate creative activism, pranks, hoaxes, fucking with the man, whatever you want to call it, there's a lot more to what we do that people don't know about. And this new project that that's coming out in September is a book with a CD and a custom 6x12 die-cut sleeve thing that is, we've been going to automotive wrecking yards and we've been finding things inside the cars. And it's this collection of photographs of the cars and the things that we found inside them with a soundtrack. And it's a real strange project. It's very sort of voyeuristic, poignant, sad, funny, very hard to explain. And I really like it. I think a lot of people who like the more toe-tapping aspect of what we do may be in for a surprise. I don't know what they're going to think. But it really seemed like a good time for us to really go off in some really, really different directions in our work. Because it's frustrating. It's sort of neat to be sort of described and thought of in a certain way, but it also feels really limiting, too. Like you're stuck in a box. You're like, I never wanted to. I always was proud of the fact that no one could label what we did or describe it, but now we're in the culture jamming box. So, anyway, let's see. Yes, right there. Oh, absolutely. Could everyone hear that? Yes, just give her the microphone.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's that tiny, tiny, tiny switch. Well, she's talking about if you would like to go to a meeting about women learning how to use new tools. There's a hand back there. Yes. Say that louder. It's corporate sponsorship? Well, it's just, I don't know if I'm understanding your question, but I mean, is it a bad question? I don't know how a corporate sponsorship would fight our battles for us, though what I do wish is I wish that someone who's in the music business who's making real money off of samples, like the Beastie Boys, I wish that they would take on one of these cases, get themselves sued, and then fight it. And that would actually make, you know, the case has yet to come up where someone actually fights over that kind of stuff for real. With money. So anyway, we are at 10 o'clock and I really am amazed that so many people came to hear what I had to say. I'm really surprised and I want to thank you very, very much, and I will be out there to talk more with whoever wants to talk to me. And thank you so much for coming.